I know that's very hard to pronounce. Just think of Al, will be enough. I've been asked to introduce myself, which is not something I'm used to, so I don't really know how to do it. I'm from Peru originally. I am a veteran of a couple of revolutions that didn't quite turn right, so I'm really a refugee in this country. I had to flee Peru, my own country, a couple of years ago, after taking part in a revolution to topple the previous president, Mr. Fujimori. Before that, I had taken part in a movement to topple Mr. Alan Garcia. So neither of those, as I said, turned out quite the way we intended them to. But they taught us some important lessons, and we did manage to topple both of them. So at least that part was okay. I'm now with the Independent Institute in California, in Northern California. I'm writing a book about Latin America, which will be published at the end of this year, called Liberty for Latin America. It'll be published simultaneously in English, Spanish, and Portuguese. And I think in English it'll be published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, to the New York-based publishing house. And I've been working for the last 2 years precisely on that. I don't know what else to tell you about myself. I am 99% monogamous. I reserve that 1% for salsa dancing, which I believe requires an open mind. I seriously believe in God. I strongly believe in God. I do read Ayn Rand from time to time as a precautionary measure. And apart from that, you know, I'm just a normal guy, just like you and I. Please, questions at the end. Are you okay with that?
I just want to ask you perfect Latin American idiom.
Oh, I'm a co-author of that book, but I included myself in that book. So yes, I was. I hope I was, and I'm trying to reform myself. Well, I'm going to talk about. Let me sum up the last 500 years of Latin America in five words, or really five concepts. That's a pretty challenging job, but I hope you bear with me. I would use five basic concepts to sum up really what the history of Latin America has been through pre-colonial, colonial, and republican times. I would use the word corporatism, state mercantilism, that's two words, but let's imagine it's one word, privilege, bottom-up wealth redistribution, and political law. I will define all five of them very quickly. Corporatism is really a system that looks at society not as a network of free sovereign individuals, but basically as segments, as corporations, as groups of people in which individuals only achieve legitimacy through the collective entity. State mercantilism is a system whereby the state decides who the winners and losers are in society. In other words, the closer you are to power, to political power, the better off you are in society, and the further away you are from power, the worse off you are in society. Privilege, of course, is pretty much the same thing. It's a system that through the law discriminates between some people and other people. That is, it's basically a system that engineers winners and losers. And of course, the other word for privilege is discrimination. The state has engineered winners and losers, and by doing that, it has also created discrimination. Bottom-up wealth redistribution is basically the same thing with another name. It's a system whereby most of the people create wealth for the benefit of those who are close to power. But it's important to indicate that it is a bottom-up dynamic, because it means that the elites that were close to power put on a system that were that in a way could only survive if it enslaved the majority of people and put them to work for a privileged elite. And of course, political law, which is the fifth concept, which is the last concept, is the tool by which all of this was possible. The state used the law, which was not a principle that was above the state, but which was really something that emanated from the state, from the political authorities, to create these divisions in societies and basically these social classes. The state was the creator of social classes in Latin America. It was not the market, it was not private enterprise, it was the state. And the way it did it was through a machine or a tool, a set of tools called political law. At least that's the way I choose to describe that. Now that's exactly what went on in pre-Columbian times with the Inca Empire, with the Aztecs. There were many differences between these different empires, but basically they all organized society around these five guiding principles. That's exactly what happened when the Spanish and the Portuguese empires took over Latin America, what we know today as Latin America. They perpetuated these five principles, except that, of course, there was a reshuffle of elite interests, and the people who benefited from this were different people, were outsiders, but the principles guiding the organization of society were exactly the same. And when the Republic came to life in the 19th century, in the early 19th century, exactly the same thing happened. There was revolution, a lot of people were killed, some wonderful ideas were floated around, but what we were left with were essentially states and societies that were guided by these five principles. Now, in the 20th century, this got much worse, and that's what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about reform, about free market reform in the 1990s, but I wanted to give you a little bit of background on how we got to that stage. In the 20th century, we had something called structuralism, or we could call it economic nationalism. So after these 500, 600, perhaps even 1,000 years of corporatism, state mercantilism, privilege, bottom-up wealth redistribution and political law, we had something called structuralism. What was the foundation of structuralism? Well, a group of intellectuals who had a massive influence across the continent said that the root of underdevelopment was basically the unjust terms of trade between the periphery countries, that is Latin America and others, and the center countries, countries like the US and main European countries. And the argument was that the periphery countries were exporting cheap primary products, the center countries were exporting to the periphery countries expensive manufacturers, and that because the center countries, the developed countries, monopolized technology and capital, the periphery countries were at a structural, and that's why it was called structuralism, structural disadvantage. Why? Because with their primary products, they couldn't make enough foreign currency to obtain technology, capital from the capital goods from the center countries. And this was even getting worse because population was going up in the periphery countries, and of course they were able to import some technology. Technology travels around even if you have closed societies. And of course this was increasing the offer of primary products in the international markets. But as rich countries were getting richer, they were not buying more of these primary products from the periphery countries because their own technologies were substituting them. And therefore they no longer needed some of that stuff. So this entire superstition, this baloney, I mean, this ridiculous argument dominated 100 years of Latin America. Based on this argument, entire societies were built. And of course, this led to a crisis point. The crisis point was reached. There was nothing predetermined about it. It just happened so. It was reached in 1990, at the end of the 80s. In other countries like Chile, this happened 10 years before, maybe even 15 years before. But let's say, for the sake of argument, that this crisis point was reached at the beginning of the 90s. What happened was that, of course, this system, this argument of structuralism, led to high tariffs, all sorts of quotas, exchange rate controls, nationalizations, subsidizing urban consumers. I mean, a whole set of interventionist policies that were supposed to correct the unjust terms of trade, according to the structuralist, the economic nationalist argument. Of course, it didn't work. So what did they do? They blamed the outside world, and they said, well, we need now redistribution at the international level. So that's where foreign aid comes into being. Because structuralism fails at home, then we blame the outside world, from which we have been shielding ourselves anyway, and we say to them, now you have to redistribute your own wealth through foreign aid. And masses and masses and masses of money are redistributed in that way. Of course, your money, taxpayers' money, redistributed to us. And that doesn't work either. So we reach a crisis point. And that happens at the end of the 80s. Now, in the book that I've talked about, I make the argument that the opportunity, the golden, I mean, it really is a golden opportunity for reform. And this is a valid point, I think, anywhere in the world, including your own country. The opportunity for reform arises when the vested interests that are linked to the status quo, that live off the status quo, come into conflict with other vested interests that also live off the status quo, because the state is no longer in a position to guarantee either side the parasitic rewards of that same status quo. The arrangement doesn't work anymore. So we have basically two sides. We have what we might call, for the sake of argument, the statists and the protectionists. They're really the same thing, but they're not the same thing in terms of the dynamic that creates the opportunity for reform. The statists live directly of the state, directly from handouts from the state. The protectionists do so, but in a more indirect way. There's still some private enterprise. They own, or they think they own their own assets, but really what's happening is that the state is engineering an entire system to keep them alive. So they're really statists, but they don't know they're statists, or at least they choose not to, they pretend not to be statists. So these two sides, the people who live directly of the state and the people who live indirectly of the state, come into conflict with each other. There's a big, massive confrontation. I took part in one of those in Peru. And this happened all over the place. And it was violent, it was aggressive. People took to the streets, people went to jail, people were murdered. And this was a bloody kind of conflict. What was happening? Well, what was happening is that both sides that lived off the state were so scared that the other side was going to take over that they wanted really to engineer a sort of preemptive strike, we would say in modern terms. What was happening was that the protectionists thought the statists were going to take over their own companies. And of course, that was true. The statists thought that because the system was no longer viable, the logic dictated that they would have to take over and go toward a totalitarian type of system where everything was directly owned by the state. So the protectionists, who really loved the state but were also very scared of the statists who wanted to take over their companies and their enterprises and assets, moved and did a preemptive strike. And that's where reform came into being. It had nothing to do with us who were calling for reform from the outside circle or world. It had to do with the confrontation and the conflict between the two. So it's very important, bearing in mind last night's speech by Mr. McKay, that there has to be somebody out there on the fringes not making any concessions, because when the opportunity for reform arises, those fringe voices will eventually become mainstream. And it will be up to the political class that tries reform either to heed those pieces of advice or not. Well, in America, in Latin America, we chose not to. The golden opportunity for reform arose. It really was a wonderful opportunity. It was a time when statists were killing each other, they were destroying each other, and the fringe voices suddenly became the reasonable voices of society. And if the leading political class had heeded those voices, we would be telling a very different story nowadays. But it wasn't the case, unfortunately. What happened was that There was massive reform, but of the wrong kind. Reform was not really what it had to be. I was telling you about corporatism, state mercantilism, privilege, bottom-up wealth redistribution, political law, these five guiding principles of the entire Latin American history from pre-colonial times through colonial times through Republican times. So what was really reform all about? Well, it's very simple. It really is not that difficult. If that was the cause of underdevelopment, of oppression, of misery, what you had to do was to dismount that system. It was not about doing, it was about undoing. It was not about approving or enforcing certain new laws, certain new ways of doing things. It was about repealing. It was about retreating on the part of the state. It had been like that in other countries. The British, between the mid-18th century and the mid-19th century, repealed 18,000 laws that had been passed since Henry III in the 13th century. And that's how they achieved prosperity and greater freedom. Not full, total freedom, but greater freedom. So it was all about retreating on the part of the state, repealing laws, getting out of the natural breathing of society. But that's not what we did. What we did is we, under the name of privatization and liberalization, we reshuffled elite interests. So some of them died, some of them were defeated, others came into being, and we are left today in the 21st century, again with corporatism, state mercantilism, privilege, bottom-up wealth redistribution, and political law. Let me give you a few examples just to show how this happened. I wouldn't for a moment say there wasn't reform. There was massive reform. There was fiscal and monetary reform. There was tax reform. There was trade reform, investment reform, financial reform, labor reform. Massive, thousands of companies were privatized, and yet we're left with the same system. So what went wrong? And this is a lesson that should be heeded by other underdeveloped countries, but also by countries like the United States, because these are universal lessons that have to do with the wrong kind of reform when reform is not based on principle. For instance, there was massive fiscal and monetary reform. Yes, the government ceased printing so much money to try and bring monetary mass kind of in line with production. There was a lowering of government spending. Price controls were lifted, eliminated. And yes, inflation went down. We went from hyperinflation to double-digit inflation, then to single-digit inflation along international standards. So that was pretty good. I mean, whichever way that was done, there's no question that the result was pretty good. It's better to have 5%, 2% inflation than to have, like I had in my own country in Peru, 2,000,000% inflation over 5 years. I would buy a chocolate in the morning, I would buy it again 2 hours later, and of course the price had just gone crazy. So yes, that was an improvement. It would be silly to say that it wasn't an improvement, but what happened? Governments did not realize that the source of this whole problem was the size of government. So because they were getting so much money from privatization, from the proceeds of privatization, they made new commitments. The state made new commitment to our society. And of course, the money from privatization is dried out. You can only get proceeds from privatization once you sell that company to civil society or to whoever. You don't get money from there anymore except through taxes. But what you do if you do the wrong thing is you make new commitments. And when that money dries out, then what do? You raise taxes again. So Argentina, which was one of the model countries of privatization and liberalization, and they were doing roadshows all over the world, and Wall Street was applauding them, and the White House was heaping praise on them, and all sorts of glossy magazines had Mr. Menem on the cover, and so on. What was happening? Well, it's very easy to explain. GDP went up by 40% in Argentina over that amazing reformist decade, but government spending went up by 100%. That says it all. Between 1996 and 2001, just 5 years, that's just like a sigh, it's nothing. Their public debt was doubled. In Brazil, which engaged in more kind of in shire type of reform, it wasn't as bold as it was in Argentina, the public debt was four times the export earnings of Brazil. So governments were spending like crazy. They were not reducing or eliminating the size of government. Government spending was actually going up. The size of government was increasing, even as the world was hailing them for reducing the size of government. So that was what monetary and fiscal reform amounted to. And specifically in the monetary area, what was happening? Yes, we were printing a little bit less money to bring it more in line with production so we wouldn't have 2,000,000% accumulated inflation, but we were still using the discriminatory power, the discretionary power of the political authorities to engineer all sorts of results that were not determined by personal individual choices in society, but by the political and oppressive state. So what happened? We raised interest rates to attract foreign investment, foreign capital. And of course, what happened was that the cost of that were transferred to other type of producers, local producers, and especially millions of Argentinian borrowers. So the little guy was worse off in the name of privatization, liberalization, and free markets. Now that was just fiscal and monetary reform. The same thing happened with tax reform. Income tax went down to 35%. It was 50, some cases 75%. It went down to 35. So that was a move in the right direction. 70% of Latin American society was exempt, this time legally, not through the informal economy, but legally exempt from taxes. So that was supposedly a move in the right direction. I wouldn't deny that for a second. But because the government spending was still between a fourth and a third, and in most cases a third of GDP, which is of course 3 or 4 times higher than it was in this country and Britain and all the countries that reached prosperity in the 19th century, early 20th century, taxes had to go up at some point. So you lowered income tax, but you raised sales taxes. In Peru, it went up to 19%. Or you created new taxes, like they did in Brazil. So what did you do? You use your intelligence and never for a moment deny that a bureaucrat is not an intelligent being. They are so clever at creating opportunities for the growth of government. They are so clever. I have direct personal experience of that. So they created all sorts of taxes. A tax on financial transactions, for instance, a tax, so all sorts of sales taxes, not one, but 3 different types of sales taxes. Can you imagine that? So, of course, tax reform in the end meant growth of government, and therefore what started as the lowering of taxes ended up being really the raising of taxes. The same story in, say, trade reform. At the beginning, what we did is we lowered tariffs by about—it was not bad. It was by about 50%, sometimes by 75%. So we had a kind of 15% average tariff across the board, from Mexico to Patagonia in South America. So that wasn't that bad. But what happened? What happened, of course, was that we started creating all these trading blocks. We thought, really, what free markets are all about, what free trade is about Brazil getting together with neighboring Argentina and creating a sort of little free market, free trading block, regional blocks. So what we did in effect was to put back tariffs up again. So Argentina, which started lowering its tariffs by about 2/3, which was not bad, ended up putting up tariffs. In at least 71 out of 97 different groups of items. So most of the tariffs in Argentina actually went up during the 90s. And if you read The Economist, if you read all these glossy financial magazines, I read The Economist every week and I love it, it's a great magazine, they all hailed Argentina for lowering taxes. What they were doing was putting up taxes, except through the back door, because they didn't understand the concept of free trade. They thought they could convert this into a miniature free trade and just concentrate it in a regional bloc in Central and South America. Also, the state was really discriminating between different sectors and areas of the economy. There was a certain group of tariffs for capital goods, other tariffs for agriculture, other tribes for industry. I mean, there was all sorts of discrimination. Mexico exempted assembly plants altogether from paying taxes. Argentina exempted health insurance, advertising, cable TV, for instance. So the state was engineering, again, winners and losers, just as in pre-colonial, colonial, and Republican times. The state was really the god of that society. It decided who would live, who would die, who would succeed, who would fail, in the name of free markets, liberalization, and privatization. We can go on and on and on. Financial reform. Yes, some of these capital controls were lifted. Yes, some of the curbs on interest rates were eliminated. Yes, capital was freer. It moved around. It came in. It went out. But what happened? The state needed funding. So what it did is it created a sort of dependency on the part of certain entrepreneurs and business people, which amounted really to an oligopoly of banks and bank owners who, in return for their oligopoly, which is really a form of monopoly, just guaranteed the government a certain amount of funding. So what did the government do? It gave guarantees to these banks. And of course, when a state gives guarantees to certain banks, those banks begin to lend in an irresponsible way. The market is not functioning there. What is happening is pure politics. So Mexico went down the wrong path. And what happened was the taxpayers were burdened with a tax bill of $68 billion just to rescue most of the banks that belong to this coterie of government mercantilists, government cronies, and government friends. In my own country, in Peru, $1 billion were spent to rescue certain banks because of this exchange of favors between certain privileged minorities and the state. So what was all this financial reform worth? It was worth nothing. In the end, you had the state, again, creating winners and losers, creating privilege and discrimination in society. Then you went on to labor reform, and exactly the same thing happened. In some countries, it was easier to fire people. In some countries, collective bargaining went from a collective bargaining based on trade to a collective bargaining based on company. It was company-specific rather than trade-specific. Therefore, I suppose that was a move in the right direction. But because they didn't understand the principle that it had to be based on the individual being able to contract with whatever company he or she wanted to contract with, they created new forms of privilege. So in a country like Argentina, which is really a symbolic country in all of this era, you had an absurd situation. Mussolini's laws, which had been imported into Argentina by Perón in the 1940s, were still in place. So you still had collective bargaining by trade rather than by company, and of course rather than by individuals. So for instance, metallurgical workers, whether they were building submarines or manufacturing nails, were subject to the same rules. So what was the result of this? The only one that could be, which was double-digit unemployment. So of course, people were taking to the streets and saying free markets mean double-digit unemployment, 20%, 25% unemployment in some parts of Latin America. What about privatization? That was really the jewel of reform. Well, yes, thousands of companies were privatized in Mexico, a few hundred in Chile a few years before, almost 200 in my own country in Peru, a few dozen in Brazil, which was a slower reformer, although they did have the greatest privatization of all, which was their telecommunications concern, Telebras, which went for about almost $19 billion. That was not bad. But what you had was the creation of private monopolies. The government didn't understand that it is the government that creates monopolies. So what it did is it transferred the ownership to certain groups. But of course, it did so under conditions that had nothing to do with the free market. What was the reason? The reasoning was, I give you the monopoly of a certain market, of a certain area, and you give me in return, of course, funding. either through taxes or, most importantly, through the buying of government bonds, which is what really happened here. So, of course, these monopolies, as they do anywhere in the world, were charging very high prices or rates for whatever service they were giving to society. There were protests in the streets, and then the government, as a response to that, of course, confusing causes with effects, created new government companies, new state enterprises called regulatory entities and agencies. And we've got thousands of those around Latin America. And what happened? The same thing that happens everywhere. The regulatory bodies, of course, were in cahoots with the same companies they were supposed to regulate, as happens everywhere in the world. It doesn't happen only in Peru or Chile or Mexico or anything. It happens here. It happens everywhere. And what happens then? Well, more people take to the streets and say, this is corruption. And so scared governments, what do? They put price caps. They put price controls on those goods and services. And what happens? The monopolists cease to invest. And then what happens? Exactly what is happening this week, this very week in Argentina, with the new president announcing the creation of a new state company. A company that's going to take control of the energy market, because there's now a shortage of natural gas. And Argentina has all the natural gas in the world. And so now they're creating new state companies. So a story that began as the privatization of state companies, of state-owned enterprises, is ending with the state creating new government-owned enterprises because of mistakes that were made along the way by the state itself, but which we free marketeers are taking the blame for. So this is the crazy story about free market reform in Latin America. So I would say really that what happened is we missed a golden opportunity to create free market societies. We missed a golden opportunity to retreat as states from society. We missed a golden opportunity to devolve power, to transfer power back to the individual, to transfer decision making from a unit, from a single unit to millions of individual units in society. And that, as we all know, all of you who have read Hayek and read others, know that the only way that information can flow in a society is through individual-based rights, not through decision-making at the top. And that is exactly what reformists missed. They missed a great opportunity to transfer and devolve power. And what they did really was to re-engineer new forms of privilege, new forms of corporatism, state mercantilism, privilege, bottom-up wealth redistribution, and of course political law. And on this last topic, it was even worse. There was no reform whatsoever in the justice system. We have courts, except for Chile, Uruguay, and maybe Costa Rica, which function a little better than the others. We have courts that are completely subservient to the political system. They're so inefficient. In my book, I have a kind of description of the backlog in cases. It's millions and millions and millions of cases. And you know perfectly well that justice delayed is justice denied. So if we have a justice system that simply doesn't work, or that is itself a tool of the state mechanism of creating privilege in society, of course the individual has no possible response other than illegality, the black market. And that, of course, is a wonderful story, but it's also a sad story because it has huge costs on society. We have now societies which have three sectors. We have the formal sector, the informal sector, and the public sector. The informal sector is free because it evades the rules, but it has no capital because the cost of creating it is so huge. We have the formal sector that is has capital, has some capital, but it's not free because it obeys the rules. And we have the state sector that is both free and has capital because it takes both away from the other side. So the only one that is growing in this society is the state. Both the formal and informal sectors are simply not growing anymore. The formal sector is not these big companies are not able to buy goods and services from small and mid-sized companies like they were at a certain time in Germany, for instance, where much of prosperity was built in small and mid-sized companies. And these small and mid-sized companies, what do? All they can do we just go to government offices and just gather around and wait for public employees to come out and try to sell them something. If you go to a public or state office in Latin America, you will see at 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening, you will see a lot of people, thousands of people gathered around, just waiting desperately for those public employees to come out, because they're the only ones who can buy from them what they're willing to offer. I think this is a really important lesson to understand, because in the name of free markets, in the name of liberty, a lot of damage has been done to the cause of liberty. And we have now throughout Latin America all sorts of movements, very powerful inflation movements, that are coming back into power or on their way back to power, blaming free markets for something that was entirely under the responsibility of statists and monopolists and people who were really intent on perpetuating this tradition of corporatism, state mercantilism, privilege, bottom-up redistribution, and political law. Thank you very much.